The date is July 25th, 1986. This is a special lecture by Roger Ware at the Gnostic Society on the Millennialists.
I think our good friend Dr. Heller is probably enjoying the hospitality of a friend of ours, Sidney Lanier, up in central New Hampshire. So, keeping the thought of Stefan in mind, seeing the empty bishop's chair here, hoping to have him back, all of us. Several months ago, when his trip firmed up and he realized he was going to be gone for some time, we talked about what kind of a series we could run so that he could participate in the beginnings of it and we could run it for the 5 weeks that he was going to be gone and leave the Gnostic Society Friday evenings in such a state that he could come back to it quite easily from the subject matter that he was lecturing on. And we decided to use the series as a forum to review archetypes, some of the archetypal configurations that seem more related to our time. And in the beginning of this series, I think the third lecture, I lectured on Mysterium Cuneiactionis, the archetype of the reconciliation of opposites, the magisterial union. Tonight we're going to take the archetype of the millennium, the end of time, the end of history, the end of ages, the advent of eternity, the arrival of an eternal gospel which transcends history. And for our sensitivities in the 1990s, I think that we will come to experience what the 990s experienced with some modifications for our present condition. Tonight being July 25th is the commemorative feast day for St. James. And it's interesting for us because St. James, James the son of Zebedee, the older brother of John the evangelist, one of the favorites of Jesus, his feast day is on July 25th. And he is the first Christian saint to be martyred. He was martyred in Jerusalem in 44 A.D., and his bones were taken from Jerusalem to Spain, where he had been an evangelist. And around the beginning of the 9th century, in a little town called Padrón, near the Atlantic coast of Spain, north of where Portugal would be today, that little spit of land of Spain that reaches out to the Atlantic, the bones were moved upstream, up the Ia River, and a city was named for James, and in Spanish, James is Santiago, St. James, and Santiago de Compostela became, in the Middle Ages, after the early 9th century, one of the great pilgrimage sites, only outranked by Jerusalem and Rome. And in fact, it was the slow percolation through the end of the 800s and into the 900s, the slow percolation of pilgrimages that began to yield a sense of pacing, almost like a metronome in the deep reaches of the sensitivity of the population of medieval Europe. And as the year 1000 loomed closer and closer, the nature of the pilgrimages became more and more serious. In the early days, pilgrimage sometimes was meted out as a punishment to an offender. Instead of putting them in prison, they were sentenced to go on a pilgrimage to, say, Santiago de Compostela. and in hopes that the rigors of a pilgrimage and the expense of a pilgrimage would sober them up. And it usually did in those days, in those times. But as the year 1000 approached, these shrines, these places of pilgrimage like Jerusalem or Rome or Santiago de Compostela, became more and more serious as almost desperate objects that had to be reached at all costs. And then in the year 997, 3 years before the millennium, the great Moorish Caliph Al-Mansur destroyed Santiago de Compostela and leveled every building in the city to the ground except for the tomb. Took all of the structures, all of the Christian structures away, and left only the bare earth tomb where the bones of St. James were. And it was like a signal to the highly charged psyche of medieval Europe. Word spread through the years 998, 999, that great events were about to take place, that the bones of the first Christian martyr were bared. And that, in fact, was it not the Muslim stranglehold upon the Holy Land that was keeping Christians from recovering the roots, or what we would say today, the archetypal roots of their own heritage? And it was this seed that was to blossom in several generations later as the First Crusade. And probably the best treatment of the Crusades is the history of the Crusades by Sir Stephen Runciman, most excellent fellow, published by Cambridge University Press in 3 volumes, and still available. And Sir Stephen tells us here, the great age of pilgrimage begins with the 10th century. The Arabs had been driven from their pirate nests in Italy. They'd held little coves along the coast of southern Italy, Calabria, so forth, and also from southern France in the course of the 10th century. And Crete was taken from them in 961. And already by then, the Byzantine navy had for some time sufficiently commanded the seas for maritime commerce. And eventually, it was possible by the 970s to go from Venice to Alexandria again. And of course, with the Crusades, we find the extension of the millennium, that it was not just an occurrence of the year 1000, but that it was a threshold after which a new age was ushered in, or the sense that there was some demarcation ending a whole procession of time. In this case, it was the encapturement of the Holy City. And in fact, as we'll see a little bit later tonight, one of the great subconscious motivations in this was the separation of the heavenly Jerusalem from the earthly Jerusalem, of the Christians coming back to liberate the celestial archetypal city from its earthly captivity. And the source for this, as we will see later on tonight, is St. Augustine's City of God, the 20th chapter near the end of the City of God, on the times of the final judgment. All of these millennial happenings, expectations, where the archetype of the millennium arises, are so supercharged. They carry not only the pizzazz of the times in which they occur, but they have this double undercurrent. They have an undercurrent that we would prefer to refer to as subconscious, which is about 6 centuries in the past. And then they have a deeper level, which goes back about 2,000 years, about 2,100 years. And that deeper level, that collective level, seems to reoccur again and again, as if there were some cycle of ages, some grand circle of destiny that has come around again, but that the coloration, the skew on the rudder of this cycle is set by this intermediate 600-year period, this subconscious period. Probably the earliest millennial exposition with which we would be familiar with is in the Gospel of Mark. And, of course, it was a millennial expectation of those great times. This would have been taken down and written by Mark somewhere around 45 A.D. It is reported as a conversation of Jesus and several of his disciples. This is from Mark 13. Notice the tremendous stylization here in the recorded words of Jesus. As he was leaving the temple, one of his disciples exclaimed, "Look, Master, what huge stones, what fine buildings." And of course, he's talking about the second temple in Jerusalem, the pride of the age, the Maccabean reinstatement of the Solomon Temple, which was built with a gorgeous marble and a gold eaves, which could be seen as far away as some of the hills in Bethlehem. One could look out and see in Jerusalem this huge marble mausoleum, which was the temple restated. What fine buildings, what huge stones. And Jesus said to him, "You see these great buildings? Not one stone will be left upon another. All will be thrown down." And then later, when he was sitting on the Mount of Olives, facing the temple in the northern part of Jerusalem, looking down about a mile and a half, 2 miles down to where the temple was. He was sitting quietly there, facing the temple. And he was talking privately with Peter, James, John, and Andrew, the first four disciples. And not only the first four disciples, but they were chosen in pairs. Peter and Andrew together, and James and John together. They were brothers. They were pairs of brothers. You see the quaternary working here profoundly. And so the five of them, the quaternary and the quintessence, are sitting there on the Mount of Olives, and they're facing the temple on a quiet day. "Tell us," they said, because they'd been thinking about what he had said. They'd murmured among themselves, "When will this happen? What will be the sign when the fulfillment of all of this is at hand?" And so the penetration of this prophecy, and you can see now that the earlier words of Jesus in here are a prophetic clarion call. And it shows us that the millennialist activity, the millennial archetype, has a relationship to prophecy. And in fact, the millennial archetype comes out of the old prophetic tradition of the Old Testament, as we will see, and has a very peculiar character, very distinctive. There's no ambiguity about it whatsoever. And of course, Peter and James and John and Andrew, being quite capable of phrasing these issues to Jesus, "What will be the sign?" And Jesus began, "Take care that no one misleads you." Before he says anything about a sign, he says, "Be careful, because everyone will mislead you." In other words, there will be many signs, many so-called signs. And part of the difficulty in the millennial archetype is to find the one right sign out of a multiplicity, almost an infinitude of incorrect signs. It's the rising of the tremendous multiplicity of incorrect signs that heralds the chaos of the millennium. And only the one correct sign will yield the threshold so that one may pass through. take care that no one misleads you. Many will come claiming my name, saying, I am he, and many will be misled by them. When you hear the noise of battle near at hand and the news of battles far away, do not be alarmed. Such things are bound to happen, but the end is still to come. For nation will make war upon nation, kingdom upon kingdom. There will be earthquakes in many places. There will be famines. With these things, the birth pangs of the new age begin. And this is from our old familiar Gospel according to Mark. This is the Cambridge Bible Commentary translation. And then he turns to them and says, as for you, you four, you people, be on your guard. You will be handed over to the courts, the places of judgment. Now, of course, what is the archetypal place of judgment? The temple. You will be handed over to the courts. You will be flogged in synagogues. You will be summoned to appear before governors and kings on my account to testify in their presence. But before the end, the gospel must be proclaimed to all nations. So when you are arrested and taken away, do not worry beforehand about what you are to say. But when the time comes, whatever is given for you to say, you will be speaking. But not you. The Holy Spirit will be speaking. So don't worry about it. There isn't anything you can do about pre-thinking a stash of arguments. There's no logic that you can learn that's going to be sufficient and is going to help. Brother will betray brother to death. Father, his child. Children will turn against their parents and send them to their death. All will hate you for your allegiance to me, but the man who holds out to the end will be saved. And so here, very succinctly, in Mark, in the words of Jesus, remembered, the archetype of the millennium is that there is this tremendous threshold, and it is a condensation. And as the condensation builds up a pressure towards a single end, towards a single sign, all of this pressure towards that unity, towards that oneness, towards that speciality, throws everything else out into a absurd kilter, into a chaos. And that absurd chaos is the counterbalance, is the complementation to this tremendous honing in upon one thing, upon a purity. Now, in the prophetic tradition in the Old Testament, which is the source for this millennial archetype, I'm going to use for just a second here Abraham Heschel's wonderful book on the prophets. What sort of man is a prophet? Heschel asks. That a prophet is somehow so sensitive to the change that he works on a higher octave than anyone else. And he records in miniature, accurately, the implosion of pressures upon the one. And that is why the prophet then seeks to tune himself to sort out and throw away everything except that one verity. And so in the prophetic tradition, the words of Amos characterizing, Heschel says, the archetypal prophet. Hear this, you who trample upon the needy and bring the poor of the land to an end, saying, when will the new moon be over, that we may sell grain, and the Sabbath that we may offer wheat for sale, that we may make the epaph small and the shekel great, and deal deceitfully with false balances, that we may buy the poor for silver and the needy for a pair of sandals, and sell the refuse of the wheat. All these crimes that in particular the prophet begins to pay attention to, the minuscule crimes, the aspects of life which seem to us in a common age so ordinary. People cheat, and business has to cut corners, and one cannot be on one's best behavior all the time. All of this is the grist for the mill of the prophet. He begins his characterizing of the end by pointing out the importance of trivialities in these transgressions, and then they build from there. Beneath this pattern of carping against the trivialities, increasingly there are rents in the structure of the railing of the prophet, and through these rents, through these apertures of insight, the prophet begins disclosing, not in what he is saying, not in what he is talking about, but in between what he is talking about, he begins to disclose tremendous abysses, tremendous fractures in the structure of time, in the structure of the world, in the structure of man. That these are not just small incidents, but the proliferation of them, the reign of them steadily, makes an instability, a mud out of what would be the bedrock of man's civilizations, and all of this begins to leach away. And everything that man has created, everything that is man-centered, begins then to be problematical. And underneath this surface critique on trivialities comes a polarized conviction that there is some luminous reason why all this is happening, and some apocalyptic close to this, that the trivialities are but the beginning, and that this will mount, and that everything in its turn now will fall. Not one stone will stand upon another. That it begins small and culminates. In the Old Testament prophetic tradition, one of the great sources of prophetic outbursts, of course, was the exile. And we're going to look for a moment, in just a moment, at the beginning of Ezekiel, written about 590 B.C. Ezekiel was in a concentration camp on his way to Babylon, where he would die. His wife was ill, and everything seemed to be unfolding. But what comes out in the millennial archetype is that the most sure foundation for man are not the buildings that he makes. They're not the lives that he leads. But that the largest structure that man makes in this world is history. And that what really becomes threatened terrifyingly is the very fabric of history in the millennial archetype. The very nature of the certainty of time begins to become unraveled. And of course, what looms underneath it, somewhere hidden in the welter of the scariness of infinitudes, which would terrify, as Pascal once observed, "I am terrified by those infinite spaces that keep occurring in my prayers, in my meditations." Fearful of this. There is that one understanding of the eternality which luminously is there, if man could only find it. So that as history breaks up, as the grandest structure of man's creation breaks up, there must be some way to recover the eternality behind history. So that the end of all public authority, the end of all private scheming, the end of all accumulated powers of man is the question that is raised by the millennial archetype, that history itself is now threatened. The very nature of it is going to end. And that this is a task for both knowledge and understanding, and only knowledge and understanding will save man in this. Let's turn to the beginning of Ezekiel And let's just see here, because Ezekiel gives us the classic symbol 600 years before it actually happened. What we read in Ezekiel here, 590 BC, is actually what happened about 600 years later, when that millennial archetype came into play around 40 AD. Ezekiel says that he's 30 years old when he's writing this, came to pass when he was 30 that this happened. He was among the captives by the river Chebar, that the heavens opened and I saw visions of God. In the fifth day of the month, which was the fifth year of the king, the word of the Lord came expressly unto Ezekiel the priest. In other words, it found him out exactly, you. And I looked, and behold, a whirlwind came out of the north, a great cloud, and a fire enfolding itself, roiling in the cloud. As the cloud comes in a whirlwind, there is this running lightning fire lacing it. And a brightness was about it, and out of the midst thereof, as the color of amber, and out of the midst of the fire, also out of the midst thereof came the likeness of four living creatures. And this was their appearance. They had the likeness of a man. Each one had the likeness of a man. But as in spiritual vision, when he looks closer at the image, it goes through its transformations, its permutations, and yields its arcane archetypal structure. And as he looks, every one of them had four faces, and every one of them had four wings, faces and wings. And their feet were straight feet, and the sole of their feet was like the sole of a calf's foot, and they sparkled like the color of burnished brass. And they had the hands of a man under their wings on their four sides, and they four had their faces and had their wings. And their wings were joined one to another, and they turned not when they went, and they went every one straight forward. In other words, they are ballooning out in his vision. They are emerging. They are emerging and proliferating in terms of effect and size. As for their likeness of their faces, they four had the face of a man, the face of a lion, on the right side, and they four had the face of an ox on the left side, and they four had also the face of an eagle. And we recognize the symbols of the four gospels in here: the man, the lion, the eagle, the calf. So that Ezekiel's millennial archetypal vision around 590 BC in Chaldea takes all that time for it to come to pass. The prophetic writing in this time period runs out. The prophetic tone changes, and that literature begins to change its quality. And by about the late 2nd century BC, early 1st century BC, instead of having prophetic literature, we have what we call apocalyptic literature. And I'm going to give you just about two paragraphs from The Method and Message of Jewish Apocalyptic, published here by the Westminster Press a few years ago, an excellent book by a man named Russell. Characteristics of the apocalyptic writing. We have observed in the preceding chapter that apocalyptic is essentially a development of Old Testament prophecy, and that the transition from one type of literature to the other was not sudden or without previous preparation. On the contrary, distinctly apocalyptic tendencies can be traced in post-exilic prophecy from the time of Ezekiel onwards. So Ezekiel is the trigger. And from ever onwards from Ezekiel, there is a decline of prophecy and a rise of apocalyptic. The watershed of the balance between apocalyptic and prophecy is about 140 BC. With the book of Daniel. And that's why the book of Daniel, though it is written as an apocalypse, uses as its setting and tone and subject matter a prophetic setting back at the time of Ezekiel. It's the perfect example of using a flashback technique within a contemporary setting in order to harmonize and balance two distinct traditions, the prophetic and the apocalyptic. So the book of Daniel is an example of archetypal millennialist literature at this equilibrium point. We have already passed that point in our time. We're already past that. We've already had that kind of literature. That kind of literature occurred to our sensitivities around the turn of the century. The poetry of Yeats, the poetry of Rilke, those writings are the balance in the millennial archetype between prophetic and apocalyptic works in perfect harmony. So that when apocalyptic appears, it does not represent an entirely new type of literature in Israel. It is born out of the past, and its parentage is readily recognizable. It has the prophetic tradition as its father, and faith in the ultimate triumph of God in times of peril and persecution as its mother. So that the hope for the future is like a feminine expectation. So that the present in the millennial archetype, the catastrophic present, is a child in the womb of the future and needs to be born. It needs to be born and brought out. And the tradition of veracity is the father for it. That the truth of what is happening now obtains its existential electricity because it is in a direct line with the veracity of what has already occurred and already has been real in that way. And thus, if this birth is affected rightly, the future will be real. It will not be a problematic future, an ambiguous future. It will actually occur. But if the birth does not occur, there will be no future. That will be the end. And so the millennial archetype has this peculiar character, this incredible character to it. So that, but though recognizable as a child of prophecy, apocalyptic develops traits which mark it out from its forebears. Despite its likeness to prophecy, it nevertheless, in many respects, is a new creation with a character and personality of its own. And the character of Jewish apocalyptic throughout the intertestamental period is complex in the extreme. There are many differences between various books in the apocalyptic literature. A lot of the Nag Hammadi material is apocalyptic literature. When we look at it, there are apocalypses. The book of Revelation attributed to St. John is an apocalypse. And when you look at the structure of it, in the first part of the book of Revelations, which I've had to leave out because of time tonight, it's not about St. John the Evangelist at all, but it's a remembering of John the Baptist. And John the Baptist's apocalyptic vision as the forerunner. And so there's a great complexity in the Revelation. There is a division then, a division of time into two periods, of two ages, and that the interface between them is an ecstatic, terrific, wisdom-saturated threshold. And that the only way for someone who is in the previous age to get to the other age, to get through, is to dissolve themselves in that terror, in that ecstasy, in that wisdom, so that they are permeable and may pass through that membrane of the terrific, wise, ecstasis present that is the defining edge of the age. And that those who cannot give themselves up to that transition will be stopped by that membrane and they will perish because everything, all time, up to that point in that mode is going to cease to have any validity, any veracity. Nothing that they do will be real. It simply will no longer occur. What good are $500 bills if there's no bank to honor them? It's like that. But in the psychological terms and in collective archetypal terms. So that when we find an example of apocalyptic literature now exactly around 0 BC, it will have an eerie kind of a quality to it. It will have a desperate warfare with eternity, a warfare with the eternal reality against the insistence on the worldliness that this previous age continue, that business continue as usual, that we keep our personalities, we keep our possessions, we keep our hedge money, our authority. We're not going to let it go. And so this is what is going to occur. And of course we have such a document. It was found with the Dead Sea Scrolls, and it's called the Scroll of the War of the Suns against the War of the Suns of Light against the Suns of Darkness. And this is a translation from the Dead Sea Scrolls in English by G. Vermes, Giza Vermes. This is how that scroll begins. It's written around 10 BC. This is for the Master. The rule of war on the unleashing of the attack of the Sons of Light against the company of the Sons of Darkness, the army of Satan, against the band of Edom, Moab, and the sons of Ammon, and against the army of the sons of the East and the Philistines, and against the bands of the Kittim of Assyria and their allies, the ungodly of the covenant. So this is an attack manual for the unleashing of the Sons of Light. This shall be a time of salvation for the people of God, an age of dominion for all the members of his company, and of everlasting destruction for the company of Satan. The confusion of the sons of Japheth shall be great, and Assyria shall fall unsuccored. The dominion of the Kittim, the Romans, shall come to an end, and iniquity shall be vanquished, leaving no remnant. For the sons of darkness there shall be no escape. And then the seasons of righteousness shall shine over all the ends of earth, and they shall go on shining until all the seasons of darkness are consumed. And at the season appointed by God, his exalted greatness shall shine eternally to the peace, blessing, glory, joy, and long life of all the sons of light. There shall be terrible carnage, and the sons of light shall be victorious. So that there is an aggressive rhetoric here, that there is no turning back, that the engagement is not one that is problematical, but is necessary, is unavoidable, is in fact now happening. And if one withdraws, one simply falls back into the shreds of the perishing age just falling past. I meant to bring it, and I forgot to bring it. I was going to put next to this Virgil's fourth eclogue, his so-called messianic eclogue, and I'm sorry that I forgot to bring the volume here. But in the fourth eclogue, written about 40 BC, Virgil talks about how in the great cycle of ages that a new age has come around because there has been the birth of a divine child. And that divine child with the sacred star is going to herald the new age. And of course he was writing it for Augustus, for the Augustan principate to be, but later he was considered as a prophet in the Christian tradition because of predicting the supposedly predicting the birth of Christ. All of the specifications in the war rule are detailed. There are certain formations. For instance, when the battle formations are marshaled facing the enemy, formation facing formation. In other words, there is a structure to this battle. It's not just a pell-mell melee, but there is a structure. There is a pattern to this. The millennial archetype has a definite pattern. It can be recognized. It can be intellectually understood. Seven priests of the sons of Aaron shall advance from the middle gates to the place between the formations. So this seven priests, and of course we recognize the seven seals in the Revelation and so forth. They shall be clothed in vestments of white cloth of flax, in a fine white linen tunic, and fine linen breeches. And they shall be girdled with fine cloth of flax, embroidered with blue, purple, and scarlet thread, a many-colored design worked by a craftsman. And on their heads they shall wear mitered turbans, and this shall be battle raiment, not to be taken into any holy sanctuary. So this is the arraignment, which is the last costume of the closing age. This battle is in fact the closing of the age. It's not so much a battle of men against men, but it is the last manifestation of a passing threshold of historical time where there was a veracity for this. And of course the flax and linen tunics and the mitered turbans are all a sign that this is a benediction upon what has been. And one is going to step fresh, new, unclothed into the new age. It's this kind of imagery. Towards the end of the scroll of the War of the Sons of Light against the Sons of Darkness, then, we are given the countdown of the actual happening of the battle, and as we can see, there are seven trumpets and seven phases to this. And in the seventh lot, when the great hand of God is raised in an everlasting blow against Satan. This is Satan. Satan, not so much the figure with the horns and the tail, but Satan is the liar. Satan is now the time, the temporal history that no longer is true, is a lie. That if you tried to be yourself in terms of that, you would be lying. If you tried to live in terms of whatever was capable in that time history, you would no longer be able to do it. You would have no traction as a human being to have a personality in those terms, or to carry on a life in those terms. All of that is unraveling. But notice, not unraveling on that day, not unraveling in that year, but that progressively it would lose hold, that it might take several generations, that it might take some time. And in fact, when the year 1000 came, and the year 1000 went, nothing happened in that year 1000 very much, or 1001, or 1002. And increasingly, there was a groundswell, as we call it today, a pressure to reassess, are we keeping track of time in the right way? Is this the millennium? Is it 1,000 years, or is it some other kind of a cycle which we are not paying attention to? And this kind of speculation then led to the Crusades. And we can see here that the subconscious level, the subconscious motivation for this, very explicit in Augustine, Saint Augustine. This is an excerpt from the City of God Selections on the Two Cities in this Milestone of Thought series. This is book 20. I didn't bring the City of God. It's enormous. I don't know if any of you have read through much of it, but Augustine in the City of God is very busy in reminding us that the classical age that no longer works and hasn't worked for several hundred years is no great loss. That we still are able to keep what we would like from that. But it fell into a junk heap because it didn't have any reality anymore. Because Christ took its reality away from it. And what is left is this ruin of the classical civilization, from which then the Christian civilization can take whatever it can use, and the rest of it is not usable anyway, is chaff, and just as well might be thrown away. Because one is interested now in building a city of God. and that the last judgment, the final episode of history, will be a separation of the two cities, the city of God from the city of man, the heavenly Jerusalem from the physical Jerusalem. Augustine writes in this translation, in this selection, "In this book I shall speak as God permits of the last judgment, when Christ is to come from heaven to judge the quick and the dead." He's writing this about 400 AD, 420. "For that day is properly called the day of judgment, because in it there shall be no room for the ignorant questioning why this wicked person is happy and that righteous man unhappy. In that day, true and full happiness shall be the lot of none but the good, while deserved and supreme misery shall be the portion of the wicked and of them only. In this present time, we learn to bear with equanimity the ills to which even good men are subject, and to hold cheap the blessings which even the wicked enjoy. And consequently, even in those conditions of life in which the justice of God is not apparent, his teaching is salutary, for we do not know by what judgment of God this good man is poor and that bad man rich, why he who in our opinion ought to suffer acutely for his abandoned life enjoys himself, while sorrow pursues him whose praiseworthy life leads us to suppose that he should be happy. But when we have come to that judgment, the date of which specifically the day of judgment and sometimes the day of the Lord, we shall then recognize the justice of all God's judgments." Notice now here that the implosion is all towards specificity of judgment day. And in that day, and Augustine keeps talking about a day, and we have to understand here that he is speaking grandly. He's not meaning July 25th. He is meaning that there is a day in this week of creation, this seventh day, this true Sabbath day, when this happens. And this will be, of course, very powerful in the millennial doctrines that come after the year 1000. This will be extremely important. In fact, I turn now to this book, The Pursuit of the Millennium, by Norman Cohen. And in this, we jump all the way to 1348, 1349, 350 years after the supposed millennium. But in that time, all kinds of theories were put forth for measuring time. One of the most profound was that of Joachim of Fiora, who said that there are three great ages. There is an age of the Father, which was the Old Testament, an age of the Son, which is the New Testament, and an age of the Holy Ghost, which will be a third testament, a totally different age. And that, in fact, the only way to understand when this third age is going to come from is to make these mystical visionary diagrams of the organic progression of man in terms of trees. In fact, when Joachim drew them out, he was a very interesting visionary artist, as well as being a priest and a visionary. He drew them so that these trees, where there would be roots of the trees, there was instead the upside down head of an eagle. And so sometimes they're called eagle trees, because if you would turn these trees over, the limbs of the trees would be arranged like the wings and the tail feathers of the eagle, so that the descent of not the dove so much, but the descent of the eagle, that man's whole experience in time is a descent of the eagle of the spirit of the divine, and that the recursive reverberation of this descent, which is an eternal occurrence, that time is just the rippling recursive feeding back up through this plunge to the blossoming in the tail feathers of the eagle, in the top of the tree of man's experience of coming back to the wholeness of eternity. That only by realizing all of his history and what it has meant as a unity can he then come to in eternity. A very, very powerful visionary doctrine. This is about 1200, 1190, 1200 AD in Italy. Two figures stand out in Joachim de Fiora, two figures that make this possible. One of them is a world emperor who is able to unite all of history, all of the people who are alive at that time, because they unite all of history, and an angelic pope. A pope who is angel nature and not of man nature. And so that this is a peculiar revolution, a visionary revolution. The age of the spirit would be ushered in as a fantastic revolutionary event, totally different from what had happened in the previous age. That the third age would then come in, and there would be visionaries who would reorganize the earth under the continuity and authority of this spiritual revolution. The quality of life in the third age would be mystical, and this is what Joachim looks for and looks forward to. All of this comes to a fore around 1348 and 1349 in Europe, because this is the apex of the Black Plague. 1348. We have some paltry, minuscule intuition because of the AIDS crisis today. Imagine the AIDS crisis about 10,000, 20,000 times. That's what the Black Plague was like in 1348 in Europe. You know the children's song, Ring Around the Rosie? This is the buboes of the Black Plague, the first sign that you have it. Ashes, ashes, we all fall down. The macabre remembrance in children's playground songs of the fact that a third of the population across the board was killed in a year. Unseen. Who knows? One of the best presentations of that is in Boccaccio's Decameron. The young people in the Decameron, they're in their 19 and 20, and they've decided that they're all going to die, so why don't they go up into the hills and spend a week or so together and tell each other stories. And the Decameron are the stories that they tell before their certain death. What is the outcome of that? The outcome is that the millennial archetype, still alive. This was not the case after Augustine. This was not the case after Ezekiel. Something else has happened. That the millennial archetype is still alive, has not gone away, has not had its day, has not had its epoch, but is still alive and coursing, and the catastrophic events of 1348 bring it back full force as if that were the millennium. And in 1349, all over Europe is a phenomenon known as the flagellant movement. I don't know if you remember, maybe 25 years ago, one of Ingmar Bergman's films. I forget the film now. Maybe it was in the seventh seal of the long chain of people whipping themselves, and of course they're all not only afraid to die, but are dying. The second half of 1349, the flagellant movement had become a force, an anarchic force, which was dissolving all temporal authority in Europe across the board. That what was the temporal authority? The large estates, the feudal order, the small merchant guilds and so forth. All of that was being dissolved. None of that was able to hold. And the millennial archetype was there, rising, coming out quite forcefully. Princes and bishops in areas disturbed by the flagellants turned to the Sorbonne for advice, theological advice. Is this the end of the age? The Sorbonne referred the matter to the Pope at Avignon. The Pope is not even in Rome. They're exiled in Avignon. It must be the end of the age. You can see how everything synchronistically seemed to fit. But they also sent him one of its doctors, a Flemish monk, Jean de Fait, who had studied the movement in his homeland, and when the plague had first reached southern France in May of the preceding year, Clement VI had himself instituted public flagellations in which vast numbers of both sexes had taken part. Later he had realized the danger of such performances, and when they reached Avignon, they received a rebuke. In October 1349, the Pope then issued a bull against the flagellants, and after summarizing their doctrinal vagaries and their offenses against the clergy and the Jews, the bull pointed out that these people were already ignoring secular authorities and added, if they were not opposed now, they might soon be beyond opposing. The sect was to be suppressed. But notice now, this is not a sect. It's an archetypal possession. Mass hysteria, we say, but mass hysteria is paltry compared to archetypal possession. Absolutely. All of these movements, 1349, 1352, quash this archetype. To eradicate this sect, did eradicate that sect and produce dozens of other sects in which the millennial archetype was viable. And by the end of the 1300s, there were all kinds of movements all over Europe, the heresy of the free spirit being probably one of the most noticeable. They were called perfecti, just like the Catharus perfecti. So that the heresy of the free spirit demands a place in any survey of revolutionary eschatology. It's like a radiation leak. It's like the millennial archetype when it was raised around the year 1000 with the Crusades was never satisfied. Was never handled right, went underground, was evoked again, and came out tremendously strong in the middle of the 14th century, was quashed and went into dozens and dozens of different sects. And the nature of this now is that the millennial archetype begins to appeal to people in terms of revolutionary eschatology. If we can get our sect going and convince others, we will make the new age. That the new age is not going to happen automatically, but man has to make it happen. And the realization increasingly towards the end of the 14th century is that the reason it didn't happen is because man didn't make it happen yet. That the new age can only come from man. The first age is from God the Father, the second age is from the Son, the third age is from man. Man has to take control. It is man who must be filled with the Holy Spirit, and man who must change this world. And so a whole new collective psychological profundity, which we could call, and Cohen calls here, revolutionary eschatology, begins to take effect. And by the 1400s, this is going to be really very, very, very powerful. What comes into play here is that it takes a very special person to bring this into manifestation. And notice now that the day of judgment, which was the implosion in the previous cycle, the millennial archetype in Augustine was the day of judgment. It changes because it's not a day of judgment so much because we're dealing with man. The day of judgment becomes a special person who is able to lead this special sect, the Superman. The advent of the Superman becomes the herald of the New Age, the Antichrist, if you will. Becomes the sign, the signal among all of them. That's the one to follow. And increasingly then, the core of the heresy of the free spirit, to use an example, lay in the adept's attitude towards himself. He believed that he had attained a perfection so absolute that he was incapable of sin. He could do no wrong. And as long as he kept the intensity of his conviction that he could do no wrong, he was exempt then from all of the constraints of time or history or civil authority or religious authority. He was a free agent. And because the millennium hadn't been ushered in yet, the milieu where he would be understood has not yet arrived, so he cannot be called to judgment or to justice in terms of an old which is going to go away. But he gauges himself in terms of his intensity and his devotion towards ushering in a context where he will be justified, and the only harbinger of that is the leader, the Superman, the mastermind, the super guru, the Führer. So we have rising up a doctrine of mystical anarchism, of revolutionary eschatology, because the millennial archetype is still alive and working. And in fact, I don't have time to go into all of it. One of the great outbreaks of this was in 1525 in Germany, a man named Thomas Munzer. It's very interesting because this is Luther's time. This was called in history the Peasants' War. 100,000 people were killed in 1525 in what we today recognize as Germany. This was an army of peasants that were gathering around. In this case, the man was called Munzer. And he said that God was communicating to him directly, and that's why he alone could deliver this message. What I'm reading for Cohen now. What Munzer needed, if he was to become a new man, sure of himself and of his aim in life, was not a need indeed to be found in Luther's doctrine of justification by faith alone. It was to be found rather in the militant and bloodthirsty, by now it's bloodthirsty, millenarianism that was unfolded to him when in 1520 he took up a ministry in the town of Zwickau and came in contact with a weaver named Nicholas Storch. Zwickau lies close to the Bohemian border. Storch himself had been in Bohemia, and it was essentially the old Taborite doctrines that were revived in Storch's teaching. He proclaimed that now, as in the days of the apostles, God was communicating directly with his elect, and the reason for this was that the last days were at hand. First, the Turks must conquer the world, and Antichrist must rule over it. But then, and it would be very soon, the elect would rise up in righteousness and annihilate all the godless, so that the second coming could take place and the millennium begin. This was 460 years ago. By force of arms, the elect must prepare the way for the millennium. But who were to be the elect? In Munzer's view, they were those who had received the Holy Spirit, or as he called it, the living Christ. And in his writings, as in those of all the spiritual libertines, a clear distinction is established between the historical Christ and the living or inner Christ, who is imagined as being born in an individual soul, and it is the latter who possesses redemptive power alone. Yet in one respect, the historical Christ retains great significance. By submitting to crucifixion, he had pointed the way to salvation. What is that way? If one has an inner Christ, then one gives oneself up to conscious suffering. One frees others not by killing them for their wrongs, but by sacrificing one's life for their wholeness. But it's turned around here. Why is it turned around? In fact, it's not just turned around, but it's specifically turned inside out and upside down. It's what's called in logic a contrapositive image. It's inside out and upside down. And this is one way to recognize possession by the millennial archetype. Perfect case in point is the Nazi use of the swastika. It's exactly the negative, upside down use of what that symbol really was. And you can recognize this in personalities, even to clinical accuracy. The streets are full, people. The streets are full. Finally, the appeal came when Munzer added a whole series of references to apocalyptic prophecies in the Bible, and the prophecy of the Messianic kingdom in Ezekiel became the ground of all of this root. So he goes back to Ezekiel, the Messianic kingdom, and roots it firmly in that tradition. Well, we have come a long way, and we've seen a lot of this stack, and there's much more. Some of the individuals who worked with this in our time, of course, are Jung and Kandinsky and Yeats, individuals who tried to understand what was happening to themselves in the largest, deepest sense. And the resolutions of, say, these three individuals in this order, Kandinsky sought to try to objectify in an abstract expression the symbolic nature of the mind so that one would not be susceptible to manipulation by the possession. Yeats sought to put it into a ritual exorcism in terms of an artistic presentation, in terms of poetry or drama, so that one could get it out of oneself, out onto the stage, onto the page. Jung, of course, we're all familiar with, attempted to integrate consciousness to the point that it could assimilate even this tremendous electrifying, energizing of the archetype. And these were ingenious resolutions in the early part of the 20th century. None of them worked. None of them were effective. And we, in our time today, rather face a very peculiar situation. We have dozens and dozens of ways that would work, and we're not employing any of them at all. And the situation continues, not so much to drift or to fester, but simply to manifest itself. So this is not a very happy note to leave you on, except that there are probably resolutions that will come in good order. As Uncle Carl once observed, the great thing about an archetypal illness is that the archetypal solution is within the illness itself. And probably the fastest way to get cured is just to go through the illness and have it. Well, that's as much as I can do tonight. Thank you.